Chapter 2. There is a Technic civilization, Captain. Scanners reveal a sophisticated network of roads, moderate electromagnetic activity, indicative of...
Never mind the details, Dr. Montessori, our commander interrupted, leaping out of his slouch chair and bounding over to my station.
At 5.5 feet, he was tall for a demi. Still, I made certain to stoop a little, giving him the best light.
"Are they over 16 on the Turgenev scale?" he asked urgently. "Can we make contact?"
"Contact, I rubbed my chin, a human mannerism that our crew expected from their Earthling advisor. "I would say so, Captain, though to be precise..."
"Great! Let's go on down, then!"
I tried entreating. "What's the hurry? Why not spend a day or two collecting data? It never hurts to know what we're stepping into." The captain grinned, belying his humanoid likeness by exposing twin rows of brilliant pointy teeth.
"That's okay, advisor. I've had slippery boots before. Never stopped me yet."
The crude witticism triggered laughter from other demis in the command center. They often find my expressions of caution amusing, even when I later prove to be right. Fortunately, they are also fair-minded and never confuse caution with cowardice.
"Remember, students, around demis, feel free to act prudently wise. Go ahead and urge restraint, since this is true to the image they have of us. But never display outright fear. They find it upsetting, and we don't want them upset."
"Break out the hose," Captain Ohm commanded, rubbing his hands. "Tell Guts and Nuts to meet us at the spigot. Come on, Doc, we're going down."
Alliance spacecraft look strange to the uninitiated. Till recently, most starfaring races voyaged in efficient, globe-like vessels with small struts symmetrically arranged for the hyperdrive anchors. Transport to and from a planetary surface took place via orbital elevator at advanced worlds, or else by sensible little shuttles. Like any prudent person, I'd be far happier traveling that way. But I try to hide the fact, and you students should too. Demis cannot imagine why everyone doesn't love slurry transport as much as they do, so you can expect it to become the principal short-range system near all Alliance worlds. It's not so bad after the first 100 or so times. Trust me, you can get used to anything. As a demi-designed exploration ship, the Clever Gamble looks like nothing else in the known universe. There are typically garish, dem-style drive struts, looking like frosting swirls in some manic baker's confection. These are linked to a surprisingly efficient and sensible engineering pod, which then clashes with a habitation module resembling some fairy tale castle straight out of Hans Christian Andersen. Then there is the reel. The reel is a gigantic, protruding disc that takes up half the mass and volume of the ship, all in order to lug a prodigious hose all over the galaxy, frightening comets and intimidating the natives wherever we go. This conduit was already half deployed by the time the ship's artificer and healer met us at the slurry room. Through the viewer, we could see a tapering line descend toward the planet's surface, homing in on a selected landing site. The captain hummed with ebullient energy, even when I reminded him that, contrary to both rules and common sense, the descent party once again consisted of the ship's top 4 officers, while a fully trained xenology team waited on standby just 3 decks below.
"Are you kidding?" he replied. "I served on one of those teams long ago. Boringest time I ever had."
But the thrill of contacting alien...
What contact? All we did was sit around while the top brass went down to all the new planets and did all the fighting and peacemaking and screwing. Well, it's my turn now. Let 'em stew like I did.
He whirled to the real operator.
Who's almost ready?
Aye, sir. The nozzle end has been inserted behind some shrubs in what looks like a park in their biggest city.
I sighed. This was not an approach I would have chosen, but most of the time you just had to go with the flow. It really is implacable, and things often turn out all right in the end, surprisingly often. The captain rubbed his hands, raising visible sparks of static electricity.
Good. Then let's see what's down there.
What can I say? Enthusiasm always was his most compelling trait. Ohm truly is hard to resist. Resignedly, I followed my leader to the dissolving room. We were met outside by Ensign Nota Taken, who offered Ohm a tube to hold his non-organic tools. While the captain handed over his laser pistol and communicator, I was assisted by my own deputy, apprentice advisor Frieder Cook, fresh out of Earth's Academy, and one of only 10 humans aboard the Clever Gamble.
"Stay close to Commander Talon," I murmured to Frieder, referring to the demi-officer left in charge.
"I will, advisor," he assured,
both in words and with a moment of eye contact, conveying determination not to let me down. And like any worried parent, I resigned myself to letting go. You won't hear much about Ensign Taken and Frieder for a while, but they figure later in my story. Ohm and I entered the transporter room to join other members of the landing party, and at this point I suppose I should introduce Guts and Nuts. Those are not their formal names, of course, but on an Alliance ship you go by whatever moniker the captain chooses. Commander Healer Paulim, or Guts, was the ship's surgeon, an older demi, and, I might add, an exceptionally reasonable fellow. It is always important to remember that both humans and dems produce individuals along a wide spectrum of personality types, and their races do overlap. While some Earthling men and women can be as flighty and impulsive as a demi-adolescent, the occasional demi can, in turn, seem mature, patient, reflective. On the other hand, let me warn you right now, never get so used to such a one that you take it for granted. I recall one time on Sepsis 69, when this same reasonable old healer actually tried to persuade a Mega Thunder amoeboid to stop in mid-charge for a group photo. But save that story for another time, if there's another time. Commander Artificer Nomlin, or Nuts, was the ship's chief engineering officer. A female demi, she disliked the slang term femdem, and I recommend against ever using it. Nuts was brilliant, innovative, stunningly skilled with her hands, mercurial, and utterly fixated on making life miserable for me, for reasons I'd rather not go into. She nodded to the captain and the doctor, then curtly at me.
"Advisor?"
"Engineer," I replied. Our commander's mood darkened.
"How many green guys do you think we ought to take along this time? Just one?"
"Against regulations for first contact on a planet above tech level 8,
Guts reminded him.
"Sorry, sir."
Ohm sighed.
"Two, then," he suggested, hopefully.
"Three?"
Nuts shook her head.
"I got a bad feeling this time, Captain," she said.
Melodramatic, yes, but we had learned to pay attention to her premonitions.
"Okay, then," Captain Ohm nodded.
"Many. Dial 'em up, will you, Doc?"
Guts went over to a cabinet lining the far wall of the chamber, turning a knob all the way over to the last notch on a dial that said 0123M. One of the most remarkable things noted by our contact team when we first encountered Demis was how much they had already achieved without benefit of higher mathematics. Using clever, handmade rockets, their reckless astronauts had already reached their nearest moon, and yet, like some primitive early human tribes, they still had no word for any number higher than 3. Oh, today, some of the finest mathematical minds in the universe are from Dem, and yet they cling, by almost superstitious tradition, to a convention in daily conversation that any number higher than 3 is many. There followed a hum and a rattling wheeze, then a panel hissed open, and several impressive figures emerged from a swirling mist, all attired in lime-green jumpsuits. They were demi-shaped and possessed a demi's delicately pointy teeth, but they were also powerfully muscled and tall as a human. Across their chests, in big letters, were written Jums, Smet, Wems, Kowalski. They stepped before the captain and saluted. He, in turn, retreated a pace and curtly motioned them to step aside. One learns quickly in the service, never make a habit of standing too close to greenies. When they moved out of the way, it brought into view a smaller figure who had been standing behind them, also dressed in lime green. Her crisp salute tugged the tunic of her uniform, pulling crossed bandoliers tightly across her chest, a display which normally would have put the captain into a panting sweat, calling for someone to relieve him at the con. Here the sight rocked him back in dismay. "Lieutenant Gayla Morel, Captain," she introduced herself. "You and your party will be safe with us on the job." Snappily, she saluted a second time and stepped over to join her team. Along the way, her gaze swept past me. "Advisor," she said, and I nodded back. "Lieutenant." "Oh, hell," Ohm muttered to me as the security team took up stations behind us. "A girl, Greenie. I hate it when that happens." On that occasion, I silently agreed. This particular young officer had spent much of the voyage out from Nebula Base 12 pestering me with questions, one of those intellectually voracious demis you'll meet who are fascinated by all things human. Once, she even brought me a steaming bowl of our Earthling indispensable Campbell leek soup. Standing there with her, commanding a security detail that was about to land on an alien world, I had to admit that I would kind of miss the attention. All I could do is shrug and share a brief glance with Nuts. I already agreed with her dour feeling about this mission. The dissolution techs finished gathering any metal or mechanical objects from us to be put in pneumatic tubes. Guts made sure, as always, that his medical kit went into the tube last, so it would be readily available upon arrival. A bit of mature, human-style prudence that he then proceeded to spoil by saying, "Always try to slurry with a syringe on top." "Yep," the captain nodded perfunctorily. "In case of post-nozzle drip." But at that moment he was more interested in guns than puns, checking to make sure that there were fresh nanos loaded in a formidable backup blaster before sliding it into a tube. Time for a brief formality. Into the chamber trooped a trio of figures wearing dark cloaks with heavy cowls almost completely covering their faces. Priests of Yahtzi, practitioners of what passes for religion among demis, which amounts to a mélange of ancient pre-contact mythologies and whatever alien belief system happens to suit their fancy at any moment. Mostly recruited from the kitchen staff, These part-time clerics knew better than to delay the captain very long when he was eager to lead an away team, so they kept it short. Om and the others bowed their heads, pressing the heels of both hands against their temples, while I, politely, folded mine in front of me as the three hooded ecclesiasts performed their minimal blessing, shaking at each of us a can containing 6 dice and invoking the name of the Great Lady of Luck in unison, spilling the dice onto a tray. 3 ones and 3 sixes. My crewmates shivered, and even I felt a brief superstitious chill. But our captain grinned as the priests exited, stripping off their robes and hurrying back to the galley. Om summarized his interpretation of the augury.
A rough beginning followed by a triumphant ending. Sounds like a perfect adventure, eh, advisor?
Unless it's the other way around. I could not help but roll my eyes as the door to the chamber sealed with a loud hiss.
Ready, sir?
Ensign Taken asked from the control room, her voice transmitting through the transparent window. Another humanophile, but less intellectually inclined than Lieutenant Morell, she tried to catch my gaze even as she addressed the captain. Her nickname, Eyes, came from big doe-like irises that she flashed whenever I looked her way. She was very pretty, as demis go, and they will go all the way at the drop of a bootlace.
Do it, do it, do it! Om urged, rocking from foot to foot, his patience at an end.
She turned a switch, and I felt a powerful tingling sensation. For those of you who've never slurried, there can be no describing what it's like to have a beam zap through you, reading the position of every cell in your body. Then comes the rush of solvent fluid, flooding in through 100 vents, filling the transport chamber, rising from your boots to your thighs to your neck, faster than you can cry, "I'm melting!" It doesn't hurt, really, but it is disconcerting to watch your hands dissolve right in front of you. Closing your eyelids won't help much, since they go next, leaving a dreadful second or two until your entire skull, brain and all, crumbles like a sugar confection in hot water. Ever since it was proved, maybe a century ago, that the mind exists independently from the body, philosophers have hoped to tap marvelous insights or great wisdom from the plane of pure abstraction. Some try to do this by peering into dreams. Others hope to sample the filtered essence of thought from people who are in a liquid state. Oh, it's true that something seems to happen. Thoughts flow during that strange time when your nervous system isn't solid anymore. But a churning swirl of loose neurons and separated synapses, gurgling supersonically down a narrow pipe 200 miles long, giving new meaning to brain drain. But in my experience, these stray thoughts are seldom anything profound. On that day, as I recall, my focus was on the job, the most fundamental underpinning of my task as Earthling advisor. Maybe they will grow up. After all, we did, eventually. It's the hope we cling to. Or so one part of me told the rest of my myriad selves during that timeless interval when I had no solid form. When me was many, and a sense of detachment seemed to come naturally, which just goes to show you that it never pays to do any deep thinking when you're in a slurry. I regained full consciousness on a strange world, watching my hands reappear in front of me as the reconstructor at the nozzle end of the hose restacked my cells one by one in the same, more or less, relative positions they had been in aboard ship. Did I have that mole on my hand before?
Isn't it a lot like one I saw on the back of Ohm's neck? No, don't go there.
Still, while dismissing that spurious thought, I resisted the urge to shake my head or shrug. Best to let ligaments and things congeal a few extra seconds, lest something jar loose and roll away. I did shift my eyes a bit to look through a window of the nozzle chamber. Overhead, the hose stretched upward into a cloud-flecked sky, cleverly rendered invisible to radar, sonar, infrared, and most visible light. I could see it, of course, but then Demis are always amazed by our human ability to perceive the mystical color blue. A final word about slurrying. In its way, it is an efficient mode of transport, and I'm not complaining. Things might have been worse. I'm told that true matter teleportation, where an object is read and replicated or beamed atom by atom instead of cell by cell, is a ridiculous impossibility. Quantum uncertainty and all that won't ever happen. Nevertheless, there is a Demi research center that refuses to give up on the idea, and Demis never cease to surprise us. Impossibility be damned. I recommend secretly blowing up the place just to be sure. Stumbling out of the nozzle, we retrieved our tools from container tubes and proceeded to look around the place. We appeared to have deliquesced behind some boulders and shrubbery in an uncrowded portion of the park. Tall buildings could be seen jutting skyward beyond a surrounding copse of trees. Vehicle sounds of a bustling city drifted toward us. So far, so good. The greenies fanned out, very businesslike, covering all directions with their tidy blasters. I took out my scanner and surveyed various sensor bands.
"Life forms," Ohm said, peering around my shoulder, speaking loud enough to be heard over the traffic noise.
"Yes, Captain," I replied patiently.
"Many life forms."
"Many," Nuts repeated morosely. "Many," Guts added, eyes filling with eagerness while he stroked his vivisection kit.
"Let's go see,"
Ohm commanded as I counted the seconds till something happened. Something always happens. Sure enough, at a count of 8, we heard a scream and hurried toward the source, which turned out to be Lieutenant Morell. She panted with one hand near her throat, pointing her blaster toward a set of bushes.
"I shot first."
"What?" Ohm demanded, shoving others aside to charge forward. "What was it?"
She came to attention.
"I don't know, sir. Something was spying on us. I saw the weirdest pair of eyes. Whatever it was, I think I got it."
I stepped forward, reluctant to point out the obvious. The rule of simplest hypothesis might suggest, in a calm city park, that your something just might have been, well, perhaps a local citizen? Lieutenant Morell gulped, looking at that moment just like a young human who had made a nervous mistake.
"Of all the damn foolishness," Guts grumbled, hastening through the undergrowth, drawing his medical kit while I hurried after. Behind me, I heard the lieutenant sob an apology.
"There now," Captain Ohm answered. "I'm sure he, she, or it, is just stunned. You did use the stun setting, yes?"
"Sir!"
When I glanced back, he was leading her with one arm, his other sliding around her shoulder. I should have known. Guts shouted when he found our prowler. A humanoid, of course, like 90% of Class M sapients. The poor fellow had managed to crawl a few meters before the stun nanos got organized enough to bring him down. Now he lay sprawled on his back, spread-eagled, with his arms and legs pinned by 500,000 microscopic fibers to the leaf-strewn loam. He strained futilely till we emerged to surround him. Then he stared with large, dark eyes,
gurgling slightly behind the nano-woven gag in his mouth. Nano-machines are often too small to see, but those that are fired at high speed by a stun blaster can be larger than an Earthling ant. At medium range, only a dozen might hit a fleeing target, and they need several seconds to devour raw matter, duplicating into thousands before getting to work immobilizing their quarry. There are quicker ways of subduing someone, but none quite as safe or sure. Anyway, a Gulliver gun is usually swift enough. By now, a veritable army of little nanos swarmed over the captive, inspecting their handiwork, keeping the tiny ropes taut and jumping up and down in jubilation. Some, for lack of anything else to do, appeared to be hard at work, sewing rips in the native's dark satin-lined cloak and black pegged pants. Others re-coiffed his mussed hair. Just because someone is a prisoner, that doesn't mean he can't look sharp. Guts pushed his bioscanner toward the humanoid, having to fight through a tangle of tiny ropes while muttering something about how nanos are the winchers of our discontent, in a Shakespearean accent. Enough, I thought, drawing my blaster, flicking the setting, then sighting in on the victim's face. He cringed as I fired. A stream of tuned microwaves set to turn all nanofibers into harmless gas. The gag in his mouth vanished, and he gasped, then began jabbering frightfully in a tongue filled with moist sibilance. I heard a hiss as Guts injected our captive with a hypo spray using a vial marked Alien Relaxant Number 1. The native tensed for a moment, then sagged with a sigh. Remember, students, always inspect your ship's supply of Alien Relaxant Number 1. Make sure of its purity. Very few sentient life forms have fatal allergic reactions to 100% distilled water. Nevertheless, most will respond quickly to being injected, as if a potent local narcotic were suddenly flowing through their veins. Bless the placebo effect. Its near universality is among the few reassuring constants in an uncertain cosmos. Guts gave me a sly wink. He knows what's going on, so I no longer have to mix batches of old number one all by myself. But don't assume your ship's doctor will understand. Call it an ancient human recipe until you're sure your medico can be trusted with the truth. The native was now much calmer, prattling at a slower pace while I set up the universal translator on its tripod. Our captain dropped to one knee, preparing for that special moment when true first contact could begin. Colored buttons flickered as the machine scanned, seeking meaning in the slur of local speech. Abruptly, all lights turned green. The translator swiveled and fired three more nanos at the native, one for each ear and another that streaked like a smart missile down his throat. It isn't painful, but startlement made him stop and swallow in surprise. "On behalf of the Federated Alliance of..." Captain Ohm began, expansively spreading his arms. Then he frowned as the impudent creature interrupted, this time speaking aristocratically accented Demish. "I don't know who you people are or where you come from, but you must get out of the park quickly. Don't you know it's dangerous?" When I vaporized the rest of the stun ropes, Guts helped the poor fellow back to his feet. I was about to resume questioning him when Nuts squeezed between us, giving me a sharp swipe of her elbow. I rubbed my ribs as she brushed leaves and sticks off the native gentleman's clothing, getting his measure with a few demure, barely noticeable gropes. That was when the security lieutenant came with bad news. "Captain, I'm sorry to report that crewman Wems has disappeared." Ohm gave an exasperated sigh. Whimsy? Missing, you say? Well,
He glanced at the other security men. I guess we could send Jems and Smet to look for him. The two greenies paled, cringing backward 2 paces. I cleared my throat. The captain looked my way.
No?
Not if you want to see them again, sir. The captain may be impulsive, but he's not stupid.
Yeah. Better save him for later.
He shrugged.
Okay, we all go. Form up, everybody.
Each of us was equipped with a locator to find the spigot, in case we got separated. I tried scanning for Wems, but could pick up no sign of his signal. Either something was jamming it, or he was out of range, or the transmitter had been vaporized, and Wems along with it. We scoured the area for the better part of an hour, while our former captive grew increasingly nervous, sucking on his lower lip and peering toward the bushes. Finally, we decided to let him choose our direction of march, flanked on one side by the captain and the other by our chief artificer, Commander Engineer Nomlin, who gripped his arm like a tourniquet, batting her eyes so fast the wind might have mussed his hair again if it weren't already coiffed and greased back from a peaked forehead. Aside from several teeth, even more pointy than a demi's, our guide had pasty skin that he tried to keep shaded with his cloak. Taking readings, I found that the sun did emit high ultraviolet levels. Moreover, the air was laced with industrial pollutants and signs of a degraded ozone layer, fairly typical for a world passing through its level 18 crisis point. If proper relations were established, we might help the natives with such problems, perhaps enough to make up for contacting them in the first place. The native informed Nuts that his name was Earl Dragonlord. At least that is how the nano in his throat forced his vocal apparatus to pronounce it in accented Demish. He seemed unaware of any change in speech pattern, since other nanos in his ears retranslated the sounds back into his native tongue. From his perspective, we were all miraculously speaking the local lingo. The master translator unit followed our party, watching out for more aliens to convert in this way, a typically demi-solution to the inconvenience of a polyglot cosmos. Our chief artificer swooned all over Earl, asking him what the name of that tree was, and how did he ever get such dark eyes? And how long would it take to have a local tailor make another cape just like his? Fortunately, Nuts had to pause occasionally to breathe. During one of those intermissions, Captain Ohm broke in to ask about the danger Earl spoke of earlier.
"It's become a nightmare in our city," he related in hushed tones, glistening eyes darting nervously. "The Lycums are breaking their age-old vows. They no longer cull only the least deserving standards, but prey on anyone they wish. Why, they've even taken to pouncing on Nomorts like you and me. Then there's the ongoing strike by the Corbambulists."
It sounded awfully complicated already, and we'd only gone 50 meters from the spigot. I interrupted. "I'm sorry. Did you say, like you and me? What do you mean by that?" He glanced at me, noticing my human features. "I was referring to your companions and me. No offense meant, although you are clearly a standard. I can tell that your lineage is strong and your bile is unripe, or else why would you mingle with these Nomorts in apparent friendship? True, your kind is used to being hunted. Nevertheless, you must realize the rules are drastically changed here. Traditional restraints no longer hold in our poor city." I shared a glance with the captain. Clearly the native thought we were visitors from another town, and that the demis were fellow Nomorts, his own kind of people, perhaps because of the similarity in dentition. In his hurry, he seemed willing to overlook our uniforms and strange tools. The afternoon waned as our path climbed a tree-crested hill. Suddenly, spread before us, there lay the city proper, one of the more intriguing urban landscapes I ever saw. Some skyscrapers towered 80 or more stories, with cantilevered decks protruding into a gathering mist. Many spires were linked together by graceful sky bridges, arching across open space at giddy heights. Yet none of these towers compared with a distant edifice that shone through the sunset haze, a gleaming pyramidal structure whose apex glittered with jeweled light.
"Kalmari,"
Earl announced, gesturing with obvious pride toward his city. "What?" blurted Nuts, briefly taking her hand from his arm. "You mean squid?"
"Yes, squid," Earl said with sublime dignity as the translator took its cue from Nuts,
automatically replacing one word with another. Earl seemed blithely unaware that two entirely different sounds had emerged from his voice box.
"Squid it is," Ohm nodded, regarding the skyscrapers.
And that was that. From now on, any demi and any speech-converted local would use that word to signify this town.
I sighed. After all, it was only a city. But you students should take note that several civilizations have made the mistake of declaring war on demis over the insult of changing their planet's name without asking. Not that it ever did any good. Squid was impressive for a pre-starflight city. At one time, it must have been even more grand. The metropolis clearly used to surround the park on all sides. The now many quarters seemed empty, devoid of life. Once proud spires were abandoned to the ravages of time, with blank windows like blind eyes staring into space. But straight ahead, the burg still thrived, a noisy, vibrant forest of tall buildings draped in countless sheets of colored glass resembling 20th-century New York, dressed up with ostentatious spiral minarets. Skeins of filmy material like mosquito netting spanned the spaces between most buildings. Many windows and balconies were also covered with a gauzy, sparkling sheen. Screen coverings that I later learned held bits of sharp metal or broken glass. As the sun sank, Squid resembled a maze of glittering spider webs festooned with drops of dew. Broad roadways were congested with cyclopean motor cars and lorries, all jostling for space and revving their engines before racing at top speed for an open parking space. I saw that every Fourth Avenue was a canal, carrying boats of all description. My sinuses stung at the smell of ozone and unburnt hydrocarbons.
"Well, will you look at that?"
Our doctor pointed beyond the downtown area to where jagged terrain rose steeply toward a rocky hill, its summit stopped by striking silhouettes, totally unlike the metropolitan center. Scores of midget castles stood on those heights, with dark battlements and towers jutting from every slope. Earl Dragonlord sighed with gladness to see them and motioned for us to follow.
"Come along, cousins. Sunshine is bad enough, but we definitely should not be out by moonlight. At home I'll fit you with more appropriate clothes. Then we can go to the crown."
Is that where we'll speak to your government leaders?" Captain Ohm asked. "We do have work to do, you know." The last part was directed at Nuts. Her resumed grip on our guide's elbow might force a lesser fellow to cry uncle. Earl was clearly a man of stamina and patience, all the more alluring to a demi-female.
"Government," he answered.
"Well, in a manner of speaking. Along the way, I'll introduce you to our local council of Nomort elders, unless... Do you actually wish to meet the mayor of Squid? A standard?" He glanced at me. "No offense."
"None taken," I assured. "Actually, I think our captain
our leader, refers to government on a planetary scale, or in lieu of a world government, then some international mediation body? Earl's look of puzzlement was followed by a dawning light of understanding. But before he could speak, a low groaning sound interrupted from the city, rising rapidly to become a ululating wail. Our greenies drew their weapons. Earl's dusky eyes darted nervously. The sunset siren! A welcome sound to our kind in most cities, but alas, not in poor Squid. We must go.
Well, then, lead on, Macduff, Ohm said, nearly as eager to be moving along.
Earl looked baffled for a moment, then with a swirl of his cape, he hurried east with our ship's engineer clinging like a happy lamprey, pushing on toward the pile of gingerbread palaces that now seemed aglow against a swollen reddish sun.
It's lay on, Captain, I muttered to Ohm as we hurried along. If you fancy quoting Shakespeare, you might try to get it right.
Lieutenant Morell chirped a chuckle from her guard position, covering our rear. Ohm winced, then ruefully grinned.
As you say, advisor, as you say.
From the park, we dropped toward a dim precinct of low dwellings that lurked between us and yonder hilltop castles. I glanced back at the downtown area, noting with surprise that the streets and canals no longer thronged with traffic. In a matter of moments, they had become completely, eerily deserted. Dusk deepened, and the largest of three moons rose in the east, about two-thirds the size of Luna and almost as bright. Its phase was almost full. In order to reach the elegant towers where Earl lived, we first had to cross a sprawling zone of dark roofs and small overgrown lots, laid along an endless series of curvy lanes and cul-de-sacs.
Herbs, Earl Dragonlord commented with apparent distaste.
Hold on a minute, offered Guts, rummaging through his medical bag. I think I've got some bicarbonate for that.
No, the native grimaced. Herbs. These are the surface dwellings where lycums make their homes for the greater part of each month, feigning to live as standards used to long ago, before the great change, in tacky, private dwelling places depressingly alike, all blissfully equipped with linoleum floors and formica countertops, with doilies on the armrests and bowling trophies on the mantelpiece. And never forget a lawnmower in the garage, along with the hedge trimmer, weed eater, automatic mulcher, leaf blower, snow blower, and razor-edged pole pruner.
Of course, these terms were produced in Demish by the translator in his throat. They might only approximate the actual meanings in Earl's mind.
Sounds awful, Guts commiserated, patting the arm not held in a hammerlock by Nuts.
Yes. But that is just the beginning, for under the floor of each innocent-looking house there lurks. He paused as the demis all leaned toward him wide-eyed.
Yes, yes, what lurks?
Earl's voice hushed. There lurks a trap door.
A secret entrance?
Captain Ohm asked in a whisper. Our guide nodded.
Leading downward to catacombs below the herb. In other words, to the suburbs where...
I cut in, coughing behind my hand. I did not want my crewmates slipping into a storytelling trance right then.
Hadn't we better move on then while there's still light? Earl cast me a sour glance.
Right, follow me this way.
Soon we passed down an avenue lined by bedraggled trees. No light shone from any of the rusty lampposts onto
narrow ribbons of buckled sidewalk bordering small, fenced lots. Most of the houses were dark and weedy, with broken tile roofs and missing windows. But one in four seemed well-tended, with flower beds and neatly edged lawns. Dim illumination passed through drawn curtains. Once or twice I glimpsed dark silhouettes moving within. The Demis, their eager imaginations, stirred by Earl's testimony, kept swiveling nervously, peering into the darkness, shying away from the gaping storm drains. Our greenies especially looked close to panic. They kept dropping back from their scout positions, trying to get as close to the captain as possible, much to his annoyance. At one point, Ohm dialed his blaster and shot Corporal Jums with a dose of itch nanos. The poor fellow yelped and immediately ran back to position, scratching himself furiously, effectively distracted from worrying about spooks for a while. I admired how efficiently Earl had accomplished this transformation. His uninformative hints managed to put my crewmates into a real state. I wondered, did he do it on purpose? Remember, students, almost anything can set off demi-credulity. Once during an uneventful voyage, I read aloud to the crew from Edgar Allan Poe's The Tell-Tale Heart. Mistake! For a week thereafter, we kept getting jittery reports of thumping sounds, causing maintenance to rip out half of the ship's air ducts. The bridge weapons team vaporized 9 or 10 passing asteroids that they swore were acting suspicious, and the infirmary treated dozens for stun wounds inflicted by nervous co-workers. Actually, if truth be told, I never had a better time aboard the Clever Gamble, and neither did the Demis. Still, Healer Powlim took me aside afterward and demanded that I never do it again. The herb became a maze. Few of the streets were straight, and most terminated in outrageously inconvenient dead ends that the translator described as culled socks, an uninviting and unappetizing name. Even in better days, it must have been a nightmare journey of many kilometers to travel between two points only a block apart. I felt as if we had slipped into a type of warped space, like a fractal structure whose surface is small, but whose perimeter is practically infinite. A true nightmare of insane urban planning. We might march forever, and never get beyond this endless tract of box-like houses. Captain Ohm shared my concern, and while the other Demis peered wide-eyed at shadows, he kept his sidearm nonchalantly poised toward Earl's back in case the native showed any sign of bolting. I scanned selected dwellings with my multi-spec. Blurry infrared signals indicated humanoid forms within. From carbon scintillation counts, it seemed, this part of the city must be as old as the downtown area. I wondered about the apparent fall in population. Were things like this planet-wide, or did these symptoms relate particularly to the local crisis our guide had mentioned? Surreptitiously, I pressed my uniform collar, turning it into a throat microphone, to call a ship with an info quest. Soon the nanos in my ear canal whispered with the voice of Ensign Nota Taken, now on duty at the Clever Gamble's censored desk. "Planetary surface scanning underway, Advisor Montessori. Preliminary indications show that paved cities comprise over 6% of total land area, an unusually high proportion, even for a world passing through Stage 18, though much contraction appears to have occurred recently. Gosh, I wish I was down there exploring with you guys instead of stuck up here." "Ensign Taken," I murmured firmly. "A survey also shows considerable environmental degradation in agricultural zones and coastal waters, with 28% loss of topsoil, accompanied by profound silting. Say, will you bring me back a souvenir? Last time you promised you'd...
Ensign?
All right, so you didn't exactly promise, but you didn't say no, either. Remember the party in hydroponics last week? You were talking about detection thresholds for supernova neutrinos, but I could tell you kept looking down my...
Ensign?
The worst environmental damage seems to have occurred about a century ago, with gradual reforestation now underway in temperate zones. I've just been handed a preliminary estimate of the decline in the humanoid population. Approximately 60% in the last century. Now that's puzzling. I see no sign of major warfare or disease. There are some other anomalies.
Anomalies?
Biosection urgently asks that you guys send up some live samples of the planet's flora and fauna. Two of every species will do, if that won't be too much trouble. Male and female, they say, as if a brilliant man like you would ever forget a detail like that.
Exerting patience, I sighed. Subvocalizing lowly, I repeated, "Anomalies? What anomalies are you talking about?"
It's got me worried. I admit it. I haven't seen you since the party. You don't answer my calls. Doctor, was I too forward? Why don't you come to my quarters after you get back, and I'll make it up to...
I let go of my collar. The connection broke, and my ear nanos went quiet, letting night sounds float back, including a faint rustling that I hadn't noticed before, a creaking, then a scrape that might have been leather against pavement. The captain halted abruptly, and I collided with his back. Through his tunic I felt the tense bristles of demi-hackle ridges standing on end. Ohm's pompadour just reached my eyes, so I couldn't see ahead. But a glance left showed the ship's heeler also stopped in his tracks, staring, utterly transfixed by something. Lieutenant Morell hurried forward and gasped, fumbling the dial of her blaster. A sudden, grating sound echoed behind me, followed by a clang of heavy metal on concrete. As I turned, a horrific howl pealed, then another, and still more from all sides, baying like hounds from hell. Before I could finish spinning about, a dark, flapping shape descended over me, enveloping my face in stifling folds, and choking off my scream.